Green light, blue light. It's blue, that's right.
Call the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue to order. Welcome, everyone. We will begin by opening a work session on Senate Bill 301. As we explained on Monday, we're carrying this over to finish action on it today. So, Senator Morse, I would appreciate a motion.
Just a clarification, Madam Chair. Does this go by prior referral to Ways and Means? Or does this go
this does not
this,
go
this
to Ways and Means.
Okay.
We don't have a subsequent on this.
Subsequent.
No. Okay, so if you the motion would be to just move it as amended to the Senate floor.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 301 to the floor of the Senate as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 301 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Telfer will carry this bill. And let's run it right down to the Secretary of Senate.
Yes.
And committee, I would hope if when Senator Haas arrives, to suspend the rules and allow him to vote on this as well. Okay, now we will open a work session for the purpose of bill introductions. Dr. Warner. Wait, we're going to close this work session. The chair moves to suspend the rules to allow Senator Haas to vote on Senate Bill 301. Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Haas, how do you vote on Senate Bill 301 as amended?
Haas votes aye.
Haas votes aye. Please reflect that in the record. Okay, now we will open a work session for the purpose of bill introduction. Dr. Warner.
You have three LC drafts before you for introduction as committee bills. The first two, LC 3592 and 3595, are two that we noticed had inadvertently not been introduced as part of your tax sunset credit extension group. So those are the last two for that group. That will give you a complete set in both House and the Senate. The other one, LC 3623, is at the request of Governor Kitzhaber. So that should be in the motion.
Okay. We don't have this. We're okay to do this, aren't we? Because we don't have this on the... Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
I do, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt or enter as committee bills LC 3592, LC 3595, LC 3623, all dated. No, excuse me. May I amend that motion?
I'll fix it.
You'll take care of it. Okay. I so move.
Senator Morris has
LC 3623, Madam Chair.
Yes. I'll do that. Senator Morris has moved LC 3592, dated February 3rd, 2011, LC 3595, dated February 3rd, 2011, and LC 3623, introduced at the request of the governor, dated February 11th, 2011. As committee bills, is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay. Now we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 115. Welcome, Mazin.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 115 comes to you from the Oregon University System. The Senate bill primarily attempts to give a new, relaxed, if you will, authority to the university system to issue new types of revenue bonds. Those revenue bonds would have to be different, and they are different from the 11F revenue bonds that currently are the norm for the university system. As you recall, there was sent the part of the ballot measure last election order in May that the 11F bonds got a little bit more relaxed use from the previous restrictions in the constitutions. Now, the 11F bond, although revenue bonds, would have to be for the benefit of the higher education system, which relaxes them from completely owning and operating buildings and facilities by the state. However, this this type of revenue bond gives the university system even more relaxed restrictions, if you will, on what they buy with those bonds and how they operate it. So I think that's why the establishment of this new type, and of course with every bond that goes into the statutes, this is an enabling statute which creates a different funds that the revenue goes into, and where the service of the bonds goes out of, and so on. So three accounts and the movement of funds between those accounts and so on.
Okay, thank you. We have signed up Mike Green from the Oregon University System. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Green. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration and Controller for the Oregon University System. I'm pleased to be here today to talk about Senate Bill 115, which creates statutory authority for OUS to issue revenue-backed bonds to finance higher education projects. OUS is requesting the authorization of a revenue bond program as an important new tool for a debt management toolbox, if you will. An OUS revenue bond program would provide added financing flexibility in the event the state's general obligation bond at capacity or authority is limited. Revenue bonds would not impact the state's GO bond capacity and would provide low-cost and accessible financing for OUS capital projects. Revenue bonds may also provide more financing flexibility than general obligation bonds available to OUS, which can be subject to more limited uses by the state's constitution. This may be most helpful as OUS explores opportunities in complex projects with multiple partners, such as the Sustainability Center and other research investments. Revenue bonds would only be used if the state's GO debt capacity is limited or unavailable, or the interest rate on the revenue bonds would be less than a GO bond. Reviewing the credit profile of an OUS revenue bond program indicates that the program would likely receive a high rating by the credit rating bureaus. The revenue bond interest rate differential to the state's GO bonds would likely be minimal in most interest rate environments. In some states, Washington and California, for example, the revenue bond credit rating for higher education is actually higher than that of its state. OUS has tremendous strengths to offer as a standalone revenue bond credit. We compare favorably to Moody's AA higher education financing medians. Our enrollment size and growth trends are strong. Our current debt profile is conservative, and our reliance on state aid to fund our operations is limited. OUS would face some credit challenges in a standalone and revenue bond program. The average age of our plant is higher than, and our reserve levels are lower than that of our other less resource-constrained institutions, and the revenues pledged to back the revenue bonds would be subordinate to the repayment of existing and ongoing state-backed financing that is to be repaid with higher education revenues. Overall, the credit strengths are significant, and the credit challenges could be addressed properly to result in a strong OUS credit with significant financing flexibility and broad market acceptance. Important controls that are in place around our current bonding programs would apply to an OUS revenue bond program as well. OUS revenue bonds would be subject to legislative approval. OUS revenue bonds would be issued by the state treasurer, which maintains an important independent control to help ensure appropriate risk assessment is made, evaluate the financing structure and offering, and market the bonds at the lowest cost to OUS. bond counsel and financial advisors contracted in joint procurements by OUS and the State Treasurer's Office would review and evaluate the financing and marketing plans to help mitigate financial and market risks. It's my understanding that Treasury has submitted amendments to Senate Bill 115 that are necessary to make the accounts created in this bill sub-accounts of the OUS fund, which was created in the last legislative session, which allows commingling for investment purposes, and subordinate the operating revenues pledged for repayment of OUS revenue bonds to any operating revenues needed to repay other state-backed higher education financings. For the record, we support those amendments. If this bill becomes law, it will add capital financing flexibility that will be important for OUS to keep its financing costs low and to make the strategic capital investments to better serve our students. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The bill references the authority of the chancellor with no reference to the Board of Higher Education. And obviously, the assumption is that there is a connection there with respect to the chancellor's authority. Is that something that needs to be more specifically identified in the language of the bill?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, I don't believe so, because this is the exact same language that's in other statutes that talk about bonds that we issue, that the chancellor may request the state treasurer to issue bonds. But I'm not an attorney, so I'm not sure I could answer that question perhaps to your satisfaction, but I believe that the language is consistent with language in other statutes that the chancellor requests, but the state treasurer, of course, has to see certain things that have taken place before that would happen.
You done? Do you have a comment on that?
I do, Trevor. Senator Morris, also the those bonds would still be or need the authorization of Ways and Means and the bond bill, if you will. So they would set up that bond limit and give the authorization to the Board of Higher Education to do it, and then the Chancellor at the time would request the State Treasurer to do it. So it is still under the budget constraints of the legislature.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Telfer.
I'm just trying to avoid media headlines tomorrow, and I'm wondering if you or maybe the Treasurer's Office could explain how this does not bump up against the State Treasurer's comment about limiting debt. This is a different form of debt, so I'm just wondering if we can get that on the record so that we're not having to deal with that in the morning.
Sure.
Good question, and I was wondering how to articulate it. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, thank you.
Mike, did you sure. want to come up and join maybe?
And I could take a stab at it if you like, but maybe it would be best.
You go ahead,
either,
and then we'll go
either
to
or both.
Chair Burdick, Senator Telfer, thank you. The reason that these bonds would not bump up against the limit is that the revenues to repay the bonds are higher education operating revenues. They're not state general fund appropriations, and they're not backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. They're backed by the pledged revenues. So I believe that's the answer to the question. But
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Oregon State Treasury. What Mr. Green says is correct, and we agree with. I'd like to take that a half a step further, and the amendments that Mr. Green referenced earlier, which were to make any additional pledges of OUS bonding authority subordinate to the state paying off its existing GO bonds, would protect the state against not being able to pay its existing GO obligations based on these new revenue bonds.
Okay, could you rephrase that? I didn't quite understand that.
Certainly. If Chair Burdick, members of the committee, if the Oregon University System has the ability to issue its own revenue bonds, we do want to ensure that any existing general obligations of the state in the form of 11F1 or 11G bonds were paid off prior, or not necessarily paid off, I'm sorry, but were provided for before, so the debt service was provided for before any new obligations were made on those dollars.
Okay. I understand that now. So you also mentioned in your comments that you wouldn't use these revenue bonds unless you were unable to do GO bonds. How do you figure that out?
Chair Burdick, well, it would be at the time that we needed to do a financing of a project if for reasons that could come up that, say, the GO bonds are at their capacity and we couldn't do a GO bond financing. We would then look to the revenue bond program. Or I don't see that. I mean, Oregon is much better financially than other states, but looking ahead, you know, we're wanting to establish this program for the future. If there was a case where our revenue bond program had a better credit than the state's GO bond credit, that would cost us less to use that program, we would at that point in time want to use that as well.
So even if you weren't maxed out on the GO bonds, you would still have revenue bonds as an option if
yes.
the interest rate were
yep.
more favorable.
Exactly.
Okay. And then I wanted to bring you up here anyway, Michael, to see if the treasurer has looked this over and is comfortable with this.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, the State Treasury has looked over this bill and, as was noted earlier, submitted some suggestions for amendments. As a matter of fact, we compared those to Mr. Green's suggestions and found them strikingly similar, almost identical. So we are comfortable with the suggested amendments.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you. As a clarification, F bonds are secured by the good faith and credit ultimately of the state of Oregon. Is that correct? So even though we've issued F bonds for like dormitories where you do have a self-liquidating function, this is a whole different type of bond that does not have that. And I think that's important to distinguish in terms of risk to the state.
Right.
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, that's exactly right. It's the F-bonds operate kind of like a revenue bond because we really don't issue those unless there's revenues from those operations to pay that debt service and pay the operations. In fact, I believe that the state's debt capacity rating is calculated without those F-bonds included in it because of that feature. However, they still are backed by the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. So,
and just as a follow-up question, the arena, basketball arena at the University of Oregon, those were F-bonds, weren't they?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morse, that's correct.
Yes, okay.
Okay, now I'm confused. It's backed by the full faith and credit, but it's not subject to the cap?
Chair Burdick, I believe that's the case, and I believe that's the case because we have revenues. There was a constitutional requirement that there be revenues from the projects that were sufficient to pay the debt service.
Okay, and then if it, with the revenue bonds that you're looking for authorization for, if there is a default, how does the default work since it's not the full faith and credit of the state?
Chair Burdick, I believe that they would have first position or second position behind state GO credit for the revenues of the university system. So we couldn't first pay other expenses before we paid those bonds off. And so they'd go against those revenues. After that, I don't believe there's a follow-on, and I'm not an attorney, but I don't believe there's a follow-on place that secures those. They're just secured by the revenues of the university system. Now, one thing I do want to mention is that we have, our Board of Higher Education has an internal policy that is adhered to strictly, and that is we have a debt limit that we measure on each campus separately, even though we are one entity. So when a campus wishes to issue a debt like a revenue bond, we would measure their debt capacity based on their revenues of that campus specifically by itself, and wouldn't let them get over a 7% of operating revenues. That's how we measure it, and that's a measure that the higher education industry and rating agencies kind of look at. So we limit them to 7% of operating revenues, so that's controls in place on top of the other controls.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a pretty vital fact that you
yes.
do have some cap on
yes.
that. Okay.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Isn't that a more liberal cap than the state?
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, yes, it's 5% at the state.
5% in the state, and you're 7%.
7%.
And a follow-up question.
Please.
If you have one failing institution that has issued, you know, revenue bonds, then the entire system is obligated to pay the debt.
Senator Burdick, Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, that's correct.
Yes.
These would be system revenue pledges.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we'll have a little more time to think about this because the amendments are underway, correct? All right. We have no one else signed up, but is there anybody else who would like to talk? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Should we do this one? Which one do we do next? Are you 306? We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 59. Oh. I'm sorry. That's what I was trying to ask you. Which one are you?
Well, it's not.
did I do something wrong, Dr. Werner?
Madam Chair, you never do.
Okay, behave.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 59, it comes to you from Department of Revenue. I'm sitting in for Chris because he's finalizing the paperwork on Senate Bill 301.
Which is a laudable project.
Yes. But what the bill does is it grants rulemaking authority to the Department of Revenue to require withholding of state income tax in certain cases if withholding is required for federal taxes.
Okay.
And the department is here.
Department, come forward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
Just to welcome these eighth graders from Portland. Their teacher is Jim Kiter, and we've got some volunteer parents with them, and they're spending the day at the Capitol trying to figure out what we do. When they do that, they're going to tell us.
Good.
That's wonderful. Welcome to the Capitol. We love to have students come and see what we're doing, and we will try not to bore you to death. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Before you, in Senate Bill 59, is the policy question of whether you would like to have the state piggyback on federal requirements that relate to withholding of tax. In 2005, Congress passed a bill to require that certain payments by governmental entities for goods and services would be subject to 3% income tax withholding on those payments. There are thresholds. The payments must be at least $10,000 in order to be subject to the requirement. And then there are also exemptions for smaller entities, such as local government, if they spend less than $100 million in a year on products or services, they are exempt from the federal requirement. And that $100 million does not include wages. So the smaller local governments are exempted from the federal requirement. The bill would allow the department to adopt by administrative rule a requirement that those payments that are subject to the 3% federal withholding would also be subject to state income tax withholding of up to 1%. And it would be our intention that that would apply to state entities. I do think there has been a question about whether it would apply to local entities. We don't have a fiscal impact attached to this bill, and that is because we were anticipating only state payments would be subject to it, and we would have a fiscal if it were extended to local governments. So while it isn't in the bill, I do want to go on record as saying that we anticipated only having this apply to state payments.
And if this bill moves, then you would anticipate having an amendment to clarify that?
If you want an amendment, we would certainly do an amendment. It does provide for rulemaking authority, and our rules would be limited to state entity payments. I did also in the packet include a summary page from a report by the Government Accountability Office from 2007 explaining, I think, some of the reason for the federal requirement, that it was done to increase compliance, tax compliance, and what they had found in their research as far as federal contractors not making their required federal payments, and then also information from the IRS website in a bit of plain English about what the federal requirements are and the exceptions at the bottom of page one and page two.
Okay, and then when did the Fed start doing this?
Madam Chair, the law was passed in 2005. It was supposed to start for payments December 31, 2010 and later, and that was delayed for 1 year. So at the federal level, it is now scheduled to go into effect January 1, 2012, so next January.
So basically, and this bill would, the authority that you're looking for would go into effect the same time?
Madam Chair, it would be after that. In fact, the bill says that it applies to payments made on or after January 1, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
We have talked with
State Controller,
thank you, and they would also like to offer an amendment that would provide this does not take effect until, I believe, 6 months after the federal requirements go into effect. So if that is delayed again, it would be clear that it would not take effect for that period of time.
And how did you select the 1% as the right level?
That's a very good question, Madam Chair. The federal requirement is 3%. It didn't seem to make sense to do any more than 1%. It is a $10,000 payment, so that would be at least a $1,000 withholding amount for the state. Below that, I don't know whether it would be that much cost effective to have the requirement for the state payment to be made.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
You know, as a CPA, I hate these things. And we spend more time trying to get the money back. I'm not sure I like the 1%. 3% probably includes some Social Security or self-employment taxes and some other things. So, you know, if this goes forward, I would like to at least see rulemaking come back to this committee before you move forward on it. These are cumbersome. You know, we spend most of our time just getting the money back anyway. And it's different with the IRS because they're national. It doesn't matter what state you're operating in. Here you have CITES, you've got all the nexus problems, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, you know, if it goes through, I'd like to see justification of the 1%, number one. And number two, I'd like to see rulemaking come back to this committee before it's enacted.
When you say these things, I mean, what are you talking about? Are you talking about withholding for other types of operations?
You know, other states, and you know, there's lots of automatic withholding. In California, it's real estate transactions. I mean, there's a lot of things that say, you know, just because your name happens to cross the state line in some way or another, we're going to withhold some tax on it. And there may be no tax due. There may not even be a nexus. There may not even be enough nexus to take it. And it's just cumbersome because they have to then file a return to get merely to get the money back, number one. So that there's an issue with whether we should be doing this at a state level. And the percentage, I'm hearing it got pulled out of the air. I'd like to see a little bit more accuracy as to why we're picking 1%.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, the 1% is a cap on the amount that could be withheld. And I think when we do the rulemaking, we would look at possibly what entities are receiving the payments. There could be some differences in the amount that they're required to withhold, but it couldn't exceed 1%. And I'm more than happy to try to get you some information about what that would actually look like.
Follow up. You know, as an individual who is paying taxes to Oregon, you have the opportunity through the exemptions that you claim to actually try to approximate what the tax really is based on your withholding. That's why you claim single, four, five, whatever. It has nothing to do with how many dependents you actually have. You're trying to match what your tax liability is really going to be based on your income and all the other factors the taxing entity may not be aware of. This doesn't allow for that at all. It's just a flat 1%, whether you're going to owe tax or not, or whether you have other things within your taxing criteria that says you're not going to pay any tax anyway. This does not give that opportunity. Whereas you know, filing a W-4 does, and you can determine, try to match the tax on the income to approximate what your true tax liability is. Another reason I just dislike these. It's great cash flow to the Department of Revenue, I'm sure, and you'll get some interest off of it, but, you know, I bet you end up returning most of it.
Okay. Well, and I think in the meanwhile, if we move forward with this, I would like to see an amendment. If your intent is to limit it to the state, then I would want that in the statute. Senator Morris.
Thank you. Would this apply to contractors who provide services to the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, yes, it would.
When you have a construction industry that has such a huge sector unemployed, working capital is always a problem, particularly for startup contractors, and you're withdrawing, albeit 1%, and the federal drawing 3%, 4%, on top of a withholding normally of 5%, and you have an industry that on average is making, in good times, 1 or 2% net profit, this does not compute, in my judgment.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, those are valid points. Senator Telfer makes some valid points, too. The question is whether you think, I think in our view, compliance could be enhanced with a upfront withholding requirement for contract payments. And I think that's a policy decision that was made at the federal level. We're just wondering whether you would like to consider that at the state level. But certainly you make some good points.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else to add?
Well, if I may, based on that, because these contractors should be making estimated tax payments, tell me what the lack of compliance is. I mean, what's our record of lack of compliance?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I'm going to draw from memory. You may remember, I believe it was a year, or has it been 2 years now, that Director Harshenko spoke to you about our tax compliance report and the levels of compliance that we found. And the one of the features that really stuck out in my mind was the increase in compliance for those that are subject to withholding. Wage earners generally tend to be very compliant because there is that withholding piece. If you look at the self-employed, then you have less compliance in that sector. And I think that probably was one of the things that the federal government found as well, is you look at the sector that is not subject to withholding on the payment, and the compliance does go down.
And in that compliance, they eventually pay. They're just not paying the 90% of the tax due by...
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, in some cases they aren't paying. I believe if you look at the report from the GAO, you'll see that there are a number of non-filers that are involved, but it's also those that file and don't pay the tax or underreport the income. So it's different things that happen, but it results in underpayment of the tax.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 59 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 306.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christine Broniak with the Legislative Revenue Office, and Senate Bill 306 with the -2 amendment is related to the formation of taxing districts and the votes that could be taken to form these districts. The current statute provides that for a district with a permanent tax rate associated with it, the election could be in a primary general election, and a vote could be taken to establish that district during that time. The measure would provide that the elections and the votes could be taken in any May or November election. And also, the measure requires a double majority if the elections are held in any other month to establish a taxing district.
Okay. I don't have the sign-up sheet, but I just have a funny feeling that Washington County might want to come up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Markham.
For the record, Jim McCauley, representing Washington County. I have with me Andy Dyke, who's chair of Washington County on my left, and Dan Olson, who is county council on my right, to help answer any questions that I'm not able to cover. Do you want me to go through a little bit of background?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Senate Bill 306-2 is a gut and stuff for the original Senate Bill 306. Metro was gracious enough to allow us to do this. They've abandoned the original language and are in the process of finalizing drafting for a new measure on Metro service districts. So the reason we are here is towards the end of January, County Council found essentially a discrepancy in ORS 198.815, Section 5, and Section 2. And what council identified was that Section 5 was amended in 2010, allowing for these elections to take place in any May or any year in May or November. And Section 2 still has a limitation on elections for primary or general elections. So this is essentially a conforming amendment to bring both of those sections in alignment and mirror what voters voted on in the 2008 elections, which was HJR 14, which was the elimination of the double majority requirement under Measure 50 for some elections. So that's what brings us here today. We've had an opportunity to work with both the revenue staff as well as legislative council in drafting this and making sure that it meets, again, the conforming side of what we're after here. So this is not a policy issue for us. It's simply a conforming one section to another. There is an urgency element to this, which is why it is a gut and stuff. I appreciate that this is 2 weeks or 3 weeks into the session, and you've already got your perhaps first gut and stuff for this committee. I think typically this is something that happens in May or June. But for us as a county, we have been working through the Bethany planning and development process for a number of years. We've reached a financial agreement with the development community, and part of that is the formation of a special service district, or excuse me, a county service district. And in order to meet the timeline for their building plans, we need to have an election in May of this year. If we lose that opportunity, this basically sets the Bethany development back another 12 to 18 months, which means there won't be physical jobs on the ground working and getting the at least the transportation structure or infrastructure set up.
Okay, and then we had a similar conforming amendment to help the Tiger-Tualatin Aquatic District. Can you just give a little, do you remember the background
yes,
of that?
Yes,
this is kind
so
of a similar thing.
This was back in the 2010 session. And the reason for that amendment, again, was to bring in alignment Section 5 at the time so that an aquatic service district or aquatic district could be formed. Had it not gone through a vote at that point in time, the pools would have been closed, essentially.
Right. And so at that time, if we'd been clairvoyant, we would have just put the special service districts in at that time.
Yes, we would have noticed that there was also a sentence in Section 2 of this that needed to be fixed as well. So this was an oversight in drafting during the 2010 session.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill does more than just corrective action conforming. I mean, not only does it correct the primary election or general to May or November, but it also allows for an election to be held at other times, though they would be subject to the double majority. So it is doing two things. It's more than just fixing and conforming to the statute. It is doing a policy change.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I'll let counsel respond if I could.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, for the record, Dan Olson, Washington County Council. The language that the senator is referring to is the language about if an election occurs in any other month, at least 50% of the registered electors eligible to vote must cast a ballot. That was not language that we had proposed. That was language that legislative council placed in it. And my understanding of that is not to make a substantive change, but rather to sort of reinforce the fact that it's only the May or November elections that you don't need a 50% vote.
But that's current law.
That is current law. I understand that. And, Madam Chairman, and it's, in my own personal opinion, it does not authorize an election to be held in any other year because or any other time because that's subsection 2. I think it's a little bit of belt and suspenders language that maybe in some ways it is a little more confusing than it needs to be. But that's my understanding. And clearly our intent is that nothing would change about when you can go to an election except that under this bill you could go to election in May or November of any year. As the way this originally came up was we were looking at subsection 5 and it says you can levy taxes if you had them approved in May or November of election of May or November of any year, but then subsection 2 said you could only go to an election in an odd numbered in an even numbered year, and that just didn't make sense. So that's what we're trying to conform here.
The constitutional amendment provided that you could go to an election without satisfying the double majority requirement
in May and November.
May or November. And so what this does was this, I'm a little surprised that they put it in because this just states current law, which is if it's not in a May or November, then you have to have the double majority. But that is current law. So I don't know why they put it in here.
Madam Chairman, you're correct. It is current law, and it is a little bit confusing because at least for this particular type of election, you cannot, for example, go to an election in September and form a district and have a permanent rate regardless of whether you get a double majority or not. And I think the language was intended not to create that impression but to just make it sure that if maybe there was some other statute that allowed an election at another time, that you had to make the 50% majority.
Madam Chair, well, and that's my concern is if you can't go for permanent tax base in another time period other than May and November, why does it say you can then as long as you follow the double majority issue? I mean, that's why I'm a little concerned with that language that's been inserted in there. I mean, I can see fixing the dates that say primary election or general, changing it to May or November, but I'm concerned that this is now allowing you to do something you have not been able to do before, being a policy change,
That's a good question. Is that the effect of this language?
Madam Chairman, Senator Telfer, in my opinion, it is not the effect of that because although this says if you were to hold an election in another month, it is not worded in such a way as to actually authorize the election. You would have to look for authority in some other statute to hold the election.
So right now you're...
That's not how I read it.
And no, it says that the election is held in another month. So do you have any... Is there any scenario under which you could have one of these elections in a month other than a May or November?
Madam Chairman, in my opinion, no, because subsection 2 expressly says that if you are going to propose a formation and include a permanent rate, the election shall be held on the date of the next May or November election. I think that statement is the express and only authority for holding an election. If the election is held is I think was intended as sort of a belt and suspenders approach, but I understand that it is probably not worded as well as it could be.
Well, I agree with Senator Telfer. If you can't have an election any time but May or November, then we don't need language in it talking about some possibility that doesn't exist. That's how things end up in court. So the question is, you are very time sensitive here. My inclination is to move it along and pass and fix it in the House if we get an opportunity, but I would be open to discussion on
Madam
that.
Chair, I very much support that. I suggest the same thing. Let's fix it over there. This is very time sensitive. This is arguably one of the fastest growing areas in the state, and there are deadlines out there in which all kinds of things like this need to happen.
Okay.
Madam Chair, you won't have any objection from us on editing that language out and just keeping it to the May and November. I have a sense that it was a matter of just trying to get it to match up with the language in Section 5, which has that 50% element in it. So.
Well, since you didn't put it there in the first place, that's
nope.
Fair. Okay, thanks. Anything else to add?
No, okay. Thank you very much.
I have no one else signed up. Anybody else want to talk on this? Okay. We are in public hearing. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 306. We have before us a fiscal and a revenue statement on the Dash 2 amendments, both no fiscal, no revenue. Senator Morris, I would like a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 306.
Senator Morris has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 306. Is there any discussion? Senator Telfer.
Just a quick comment that I'm going to vote yes with the understanding that this will be fixed and amended to delete the verbiage that allows you to have an election at another time other than May or November, but subject to the double majority. So
correct.
Assuming
and
that this is going to the House to be amended there.
Correct. And Senator Telfer, I will put it on the record that I will endeavor to see that that happens.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Would it be possible to amend the staff measure summary to include a response by LC at the time that it comes to the floor for a vote? There may be a very rational explanation. Or is that outside of the scope of
we'll have Senator Haas carry this bill.
He can get that information when he carries it.
Get the information and share it with all of us.
Okay.
How about that, Senator Morris?
That sounds good.
Okay. Is there any objection? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 306 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 306 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will have the good senator from Bethany carry this. He's actually not from Bethany, but we'll have him carry it anyway. Okay. That looks like it concludes our...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Haas.
Aaron Rodgers and I are both from Raleigh Hills. Packers quarterback.
Okay.
Oh.
Oh. Go Packers. Okay. We are adjourned.
You're the Super Bowl champ.
That's right.
Did you know him?
Yeah. No, he lived there for 4 years while his father was taking chiropractic school at Western State.